The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have
they
main
are
engine hard. Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to the Friday morning California time Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston, and thank you very much for tuning in this Friday morning. Again, we're in the Pacific Coast Daylight Time Zone. I know many of you are elsewhere and listening from overseas today, and we welcome you to the program. We have a great show planned for you today and very interesting, so I want to get through our announcements as quickly as possible. We do have a toll-free number for those of you that are able to give us a call and who want to talk to our guest, who I will introduce in a minute. And so please write this down. It is 1-866-687-7223. And if you want to call the toll-free number and you're outside the United States, it is an MCI number, but your country has to allow toll-free calling back to the United States. So if it does, you ask for your MCI in-country operator, and you give that operator this number, 1-866-687-7223. Tell them it is located in the San Francisco Bay Area of Northern California, and they should be able to connect you to the number. If you want to call us and you're outside the United States, and you don't have toll-free calling to the United States, then email me and I will give you the direct dial number rather than the toll-free number. But again, toll-free, 1-866-687-7223. And then email is fine as well, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And that is also our website, so do check it out because we have a website newsletter there. It's over on the right side, and it's comprehensive, and it's uploaded Sunday afternoon after the Sunday show. So it has all of the information for the programs coming up in the coming week. If you scroll down on the website newsletter, you will get the coming attractions, what we have in store, and we're booking into the end of July and August right now. So do check that out. Use the upcoming show menu on the far right side. Scroll down. And once a program is listed there, you can start posting comments. For example, for today's show, comments have been posted on the blog there all week about M-Drive articles, from Texas about what our guest had to say, as well as some new information coming from Finnish researchers. Once the show is live, you can certainly ask questions and comments for the guests that way, as I will get them emailed to me pretty quickly. And then after the show is archived, that is our blog. So please take advantage of this. We do have a menu up in the upper left-hand corner. Check it out. Lots of items there and links that you may be interested in. We're still working with Cafe Press to reorganize our store based on their website and their requirements. And I have to tell you, they have about the worst tech support I've ever come across in my life. They don't even know how to respond to our problems. I cannot believe they have these people in tech support. It is amazing, and our patience is wearing thin. If you have alternatives to Cafe Press for logo wear and items like that, please email me your suggestions. We are looking. And then remember, the Space Show is copyrighted and trademarked. You are free to share our programs with people you think are interested. An emailed program would be in excess of 23 or 24 megabytes, so they're a little bit difficult to email. You can always send people the links, and they can download the programs themselves. downloading is only a minute or so if they have a high-speed connection. There are a couple of rules about that. So one is don't do anything commercial with our program. Don't edit the shows and then take your edits and put them up on YouTube or any other website, including your own. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. Our full copyright statement is at the bottom of every one of our Space Show website pages, as well as our parents page, onegiantleapfoundation.org. So please check it out. If you have questions, don't hesitate to email me. And we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and we exist because many of you do financially support us with your gifts. Remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true if you are a California taxpayer. We are a California public benefit corporation. Without your financial support, the Space Show would be history. So we really do need your support, and we thank you for doing it. There are PayPal links on the homepage for you to support us that way. Plus, if you're a frequent purchaser of Amazon products, if you click on the Amazon link on our homepage, you will see two ways to support the Space Show through your Amazon purchasing habits. And thank you very much for doing that. We have sponsors, and as I say, check the sponsor messages from time to time on our homepage. But the first section of our program today is brought to you by two sponsors. Orbital ATK is a global leader in aerospace and defense technologies. They are known as the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems, for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And then also Integrated Space Analytics is supporting us through their Integrated Space Plan. This is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. You can see how technologies and destinations build upon one another, explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail. Their website is thespaceplan.com. They have discussions there, regular updates, and you can participate in exclusive interactive features. You can even get your own full-color poster of the space plan. It comes in two sizes, by the way. It is a useful and inspiring tool that should be on the wall for everyone serious about space development. So, again, check it out at thespaceplan.com. So I want to welcome to the show today Dr. Mike McCullough, and he is a lecturer in geomatics in the School of Marine Science and Engineering at the Faculty of Science and the Environment. At the university, I lost the place where I was reading for what university he's with, but he's in England, and we're talking to him from England, and we're happy to have him with us. He has done work suggesting a new cosmological model for the inertial mass. And if you check out his bio on the website page, you will see an acronym, which I'm not going to read because it's a little bit too long. But this predicts galaxy rotation without dark matter and cosmic acceleration without dark energy, both without needing any adjustable parameters. And I urge you to read his full bio, but the reason I ask him on the show is because the Examiner in Houston a couple of weeks ago wrote an article titled Has the Impossible M Drive Being Tested by NASA Finally Been Explained? And in this article, it talks about Dr. McAuliffe, and he is, by the way, at Plymouth University in the UK. I apologize for that. And he has an explanation based on a new theory of inertia that makes startling predictions about the way objects move under very small accelerations. Boy, this may be one of those days where the words coming out of my mouth are not the words coming out of my brain. Anyway, we're really pleased to have Dr. Mike, if I may refer to him that way, with us. I think you're in for a very, very interesting program, especially since our beloved NASA will not talk about M-Drive, despite my efforts to get Sunny White and others on the show, who, by the way, have been on the show in the past. So, Dr. McAuliffe, welcome to the Space Show. It is really a pleasure to talk to you and to have you as a guest, and we appreciate your being here.
Thanks for inviting me, David.
Can you start us out? And there's probably some listeners listening who don't even know what M-Drive is. So can you give us a pretty good definition of what M-Drive is and why many people think it's bogus and others think there's something really to it?
Right. Well, M-Drive stands for electromagnetic drive, and it was invented by Roger Scheuer from Britain. And it's really very simple. It's a bit like a megaphone in shape, so it's a truncated cone made of copper that's conductive. And they put a magnetron on the side to produce microwaves. And with the size of the cone that they have, it's usually about 20 centimeters long. So they need microwaves about 2.45 gigahertz in frequency. And when they put these microwaves in there, when Roger Scheuer put microwaves in when he first did it, they resonate in the cavity. And he noticed that the M drive moves very slightly towards its narrow end. And maybe I should put that in context. Usually, in our laws of physics, what happens is that you have you need a reaction mass. So rockets work by firing mass very fast at one end so that they move the other end, move in the other direction. And this conserves momentum.
Conservation of momentum, right?
Yes. There's something in the new film Interstellar, actually. It says that the only way humans have managed to get somewhere is to leave something behind. And that's been true up to now. In order to propel a rocket in one direction, you have to fire something in the opposite direction. The thing that's causing so much controversy about the M-drive is it doesn't work like that, because nothing is coming out of the cavity, apparently. So this has caused a lot of discussion about Newton's third law, which is supposed to say that you need a reaction mass. But Roger Scheuer published an article about it in New Scientist in 2006, I think it was. And that caused a lot of controversy, and it went quiet. But then a Chinese group led by Juan Yang, I don't know which university it was, but they, in 2012, they found the same thing in an M-drive. There's also been an Italian group led by Guido Fetta, who've seen something similar in what they call a Carni drive. And then NASA decided to have a go, probably around 2011, and they started publishing things in 2014, and the NASA team, including Harold White, that you mentioned, and Paul March, they also found a thrust from this truncated cone with microwaves inside it. It's a very small thrust, I should say. It's only a few millinewtons, usually, even micronewtons in some cases. And the initial comments were that it must be something to do with airflow. So NASA tried it in a vacuum, and they also measured a thrust in a vacuum. And even more recently, Martin Timar from Dresden University in Germany, he's also, he found a thrust, but it was rather an ambiguous one. He found that he also got a thrust when he turned the instrument on its side. But he had a very interesting setup. A very different setup. He had a very small cavity, too small, in fact, for the microwaves he was putting in. But basically, there's this anomaly that seems to occur when you put microwaves into an asymmetrical conical cavity, and it seems to violate the fundamental laws of physics.
If it turned out to be a real effect and it could be scaled up, what does it do for propulsion and rocket and space travel times?
Well, the great advantage of having such a thing is that you could use it on satellites, for example, and they could use it for station keeping. They could point the M drive with the narrow end pointed up, or whichever way they wanted, and they could use solar power to produce electricity and feed it into the cavity. And there would be a thrust upwards, so it'd be very good for station keeping. The great advantage is you don't have to launch any fuel. There's no reaction mass needed, so the mass you need to lift into orbit is much lower. and this is also the case for interplanetary and even interstellar craft as well. So it would be a very useful thing if it is finally confirmed.
What does it do for travel times?
Well, the acceleration that's been extracted from it so far is very small. But the good thing is that it's continuous. So the acceleration just keeps going and keeps going. So eventually you can get quite a fast velocity. And I haven't done the calculations, but people have talked about getting to Mars in a few weeks, that kind of thing. I haven't done the calculations myself.
Why is it so hard to determine or prove that that the effect is real?
The problem is that the signal they're getting out, the thrust,
uh-huh.
is not a large one. It's so small that you can't see it unless you have your cavity on the torsion balance, so it's very finely balanced, and so if there's a tiny force, it pushes it around. So it could be some kind of experimental artifact. It could be an electromagnetic interaction between the microwaves in the cavity and the wires on the outside. It's probably not something to do with moving air, because they've tried it in the vacuum now. But there are any number of things it could be, except nobody has spotted such a thing, such a glitch.
So at what time or at what point do they determine, okay, the glitch doesn't occur, so this is real, let's go to the next level? So are they looking for some sort of scientific consensus? Are they looking for some experiment yet to be done that turns the table on we've proved it? I mean, what is the determining factor of whether the effect is real or not?
Well, I suppose you'd need some kind of consensus, and that would be you would gain that, I suppose, if you managed to boost the effect far above any experimental error, which has not been done yet.
And why hasn't that been done yet?
Well, as far as I know, the NASA team, for example, are not, they do not have a great deal of funding. So they've been stymied, in a sense, by lack of funding. They can't buy a lot of the equipment that they've needed. And other groups are, I think, reluctant to experiment this way for fear of seeming on the fringe, perhaps.
You actually have a question about that. I've been sitting on it, and I'm going to go ahead, and since you kind of brought that up in a loose way, let me tell you that this is from Don, and he is in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And he says, it seems to me that since something like this is on the fringe and NASA won't talk about it, or if they do talk about it, it's few and far between, that many qualified physicists and scientists won't touch it because of their fear that it will damage their careers or their reputations by being associated with something that is this far out on the fringe. They'd rather dedicate themselves to things that are much more mainstream. Yet you are touching it, obviously, and I've read the news reports on the Finnish team, who says that there is thrust coming out of it, so they're obviously willing to touch something like this. But is working an item in physics on the fringe like this a career killer? Does it keep qualified people from doing research?
Well, I think there's some truth in that, and I've had a little bit of trouble myself.
Really? You gotten in trouble for your comments on M-Drive?
Not particularly M-Drive. There's a wider context to this. I've been developing a theory of inertia, which has caused a few problems. So, in effect, I was already in the sin bin.
So you're already on the doghouse, right?
Yes, that's right. So I had less to lose, perhaps, than other people.
So, is science Why are people doing research that's a little bit out there, or maybe a lot out there? Why are they put in the doghouse? Why are they discriminated? I mean, one would think that science would be interested in pursuing things, and as long as the research is quality and objective, and it says, well, you know, there's nothing to this, so move on. What's wrong with that? And if there is something to it, then everyone would want to know, and others would want to pick up the ball on it. So why is it a career killer? Why do you end up in the doghouse on something like this?
Well, it all seems to work this way. I'm not exactly sure of the reason. There's an awful lot of inertia in science. I don't know.
Are you in touch with the NASA team at all with your ideas?
Yes, I was. When I published a paper on it, I wrote to them, and I got some very interesting replies from them. We were swapping emails quite a bit, but then it was cut off.
So you were cut off?
Yes. I mean, they said that management had said that they shouldn't talk to anybody.
Unbelievable.
About it. So.
What a waste. You have a caller already to talk to you. Are you ready to take a call?
Yeah, sure. Yep.
Okay, hang on just a minute. Good morning, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is John of Fort Worth.
Hi, John. You're on the phone with Dr. Mike McCullough.
Yes. I understand, and basically the reason that you're on the show today was because you have a theory, or the theory you mentioned earlier relates to how the M drive might be explained and how we get around this violation of the laws of physics that other people seem to think is there.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, I was wondering, could you describe a little bit about how you see that could produce a thrust without admitting any reaction?
Right, okay. So, I mean, shall I go from the beginning?
Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So, I'm trying to explain inertial mass, which has never been explained before. It's not explained by the Higgs field. That only explains 0.1% of it. So inertia itself has never been explained. So if you imagine you have an object and you move it to the left, for example, then just considering that the speed of information transfer is the speed of light, then at a certain distance, far distance to the right of that object, information will never get to the object. So there'll be a kind of a dead zone over to the right where the object will never know about. And there's a boundary between the area it knows about and the area it doesn't, which is called a horizon. And this horizon is a bit like an event horizon around a black hole. And it sits inside what's called a zero-point field, which you may have heard of. Particles come into and out of existence in the zero-point field all the time. And if you have, they tend to come in pairs. So if you have a pair form on the boundary on the horizon, one goes into the dead zone beyond the horizon, and one comes out. So you get a kind of radiation from this horizon, just like Hawking radiation. But it was discovered by Bill Unruh, and it's called Unruh radiation.
Mm-hmm.
So this accelerating object is now in a bath of radiation. But what I've said is that the radiation, the wavelengths of it, has to fit between the object and the horizon. You can't have a partial wave there. So on the right of the particle, the waves have to fit between it and the horizon. But on the other side of it, the left side, they don't. So you can get more waves on the left-hand side because all of them fit, any possible waves fit. So you can imagine, you know, about radiation pressure, light falling on the surface pushes it. This means you get more of a push from the left on the object than from the right, which pushes it back against the acceleration you originally gave it. And this is just what inertia does. is whenever you push something, it resists, doesn't it? And I've shown mathematically that this can account for inertia. In fact, in the original paper, I was a factor of two out. But with help from a colleague in Spain, Jaume Giné, it's now down to 29% error. So I can explain inertia pretty well using this method. But the trouble is that this method explains standard inertia. It forgets about the Hubble horizon. So very far away, 10 to the 26 meters away, there's this horizon where the stars are receding from us at the speed of light. And so we can't see them when they're beyond this horizon. So this is another horizon called the Hubble horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that if the waves of unreal radiation are very long, they will start to be damped or deleted, disallowed by this horizon as well. So this first mechanism that I talked about will become less efficient because this horizon is all around the object. So this means that I predicted standard inertia, but also an extra effect that at low accelerations, which is when unreal radiation has a long wavelength, the inertia decreases in a new way. The problem for experiments is that this is very hard to detect because it's a very small effect. And I can talk about the edges of galaxies where acceleration is very low. This occurs there. So the stars at the edges of galaxies have less inertial mass. So the centrifugal force that they experience is less. And so they're able to move in their orbit faster than they would otherwise with the same amount of matter in the galaxy. You don't have to add dark matter to hold them in. They stay in because the centrifugal force is less. But the problem is you can only see that for very low accelerations. But I think what the M drive is doing is bringing this Hubble horizon closer. You can... when you put the microwaves into the cavity, they have very high accelerations because the microwave photons are bouncing around very fast inside it at the speed of light. So the horizon that they see is the same size as the cavity. Now, on the wide end of the cavity, you've got a bigger horizon, so more waves are allowed. So, and on the narrow end, you have a narrower cavity, so fewer unreal waves are allowed. So every time the photon bounces from the narrow end to the wide end, it gains inertial mass because more of it, these unreal waves are allowed. And every time it bounces back to the narrow end, it loses inertial mass. So what I'm saying is that when you put in the microwaves with the magnetron, they bounce around, and this new effect that I call MISC shifts the mass towards the wide end. And in order to conserve momentum, the whole thing, the rest of it, has to shift the other way. So it becomes a bit like a rocket. A rocket expels mass towards the right and it moves to the left. Well, in this case, the microwaves, their mass has been shifted towards the wide end, so they're moving towards the narrow end.
So it accelerates toward the smaller end then, right? Right?
The photons, their mass has been shifted towards the wide end,
mm-hmm.
so it moves towards the narrow end.
Yeah, that moves toward the narrow end to compensate. Okay.
Yeah.
This is interesting because there's another thing going on out in California called a Woodward drive, where there's some experiments on a similar low, small micro effect system like that too. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I've heard of Woodward's experiments.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand his theory. I don't follow his theory, but I've seen his experiments. And yeah, he has a similar kind of thing where he vibrates things backwards and forwards, and he has them gain mass as they go to the right and lose it when they go to the left.
Yeah, which is a similar, not the same thing, but I wonder if the fundamental physics could be the same. just two different mechanisms of producing it.
Yeah, my impression was that his experiments look very much like they could be explained by what I'm saying. I've tried to understand his theory, and I don't... It seems to use general relativity and special relativity, and whereas I can't use general relativity because, well, it's all based on the equivalence principle, and I violate that slightly because I'm saying that inertial mass is very, very slightly different to the gravitational mass, so there must be something different to our approaches.
I see. Well, that's okay. That's interesting. Well, that I guess that it's hard to grasp this. I'm definitely listening to you, but I get the idea that it creates that imbalance. So you're saying inertia itself is due to a cosmological effect due to the boundaries of the universe.
Right.
Is that what I'm hearing, basically?
That's right. Horizons. I'm saying that horizons are making a gradient in the zero-point field, whether they're horizons caused by movement or distant horizons at the Hubble scale.
Yeah. Okay. I can see why you're running into some some blowback from the mainstream on this.
Yes.
But it's interesting. It's interesting ideas.
Dr. Mike, are you able to do... any experiments to work on your theory, or is that beyond your budget and your capability and your laboratory, etc.?
Well, it's beyond me, really, because I don't have a lab, I don't have any funding. But I am talking to people who are doing experiments, so I'm liaising with them and trying to... there's an American chap who is rotating things very fast to try and see an effect. I'm talking with a Spanish expert in superconductivity who, well, we might try and use photons instead, send photons around a ring and see what happens.
But you can't be in touch with the NASA people because they're not permitted to be in touch.
That's right. It was very good to be in touch with them. It was very, very useful before, especially around about the time they were firing lasers through their cavity, and they thought they had found a change of speed in the laser beam. It was very interesting to me, but that's all gone dark now.
John?
One way to test this would be to, of course, I don't know if anybody would... That would cost some serious money, would be to actually fly one of these things in space and actually, where you really could see if there'd be any acceleration due to it over a period of time, like hooking
to
a solar panel system or something.
There is somebody in California who is trying to arrange that. I've forgotten his name now, but he has emailed me, and there's a German slash Welsh team who are also doing... planning for that, using CubeSats.
Yeah.
Very small satellites.
It seems like that's where you really would get the ultimate test. All these other effects would kind of be eliminated if you actually were flying it and could see if you could make orbit change of some minute amount that could be measured, and over time it would continue to progress.
Yeah, the difficulty would be measuring the position, I suppose, but I wonder if you could have two of them pointing in opposite directions and you could try and make them spin.
Hmm. Put a torque on it.
Your belief is that this is a real effect and that this probably has a lot of promise for acceleration satellites and for space use. So is that a fair summary of your thoughts on M-Drive?
Yes, I believe it's real. But of course, as a scientist, you can never be 100% sure. You just have to take what the data tells you.
John, any other comments? Did you read the finished material, John, that came out the other day in the news?
I didn't see that. No, was that on your website or?
Somebody did post it as a comment for this show, but it came out in the news yesterday or the day before, and I haven't seen any of their research. I just read the news articles, and they're saying there's definitely thrust with M-Drive. I think that's probably the tagline that one might take away from it. And I haven't read the research in the news articles or not all there all that detail. Finnish physicist says controversial space propulsion drive does have an exhaust. A new peer-reviewed paper on M-Drive from Finland states that the controversial electromagnetic space propulsion technology does work due to microwaves fed into the device, converting into photons that leak out of the closed cavity, producing an exhaust. And then it goes on and on and on.
Well, then that would be a very conventional explanation. I mean, that would just be saying it's due to radiation pressure.
No. Yeah, it's a very neat idea, actually. They're saying that the photons are coming out of the wide end, but they're coming out in pairs. And so the sine wave of one photon is cancelling out the sine wave of the other one, so they're just not visible. So it's kind of an elegant idea.
They had a three-person team with Dr. Anilja, who's a physics professor at the University of Helsinki, Dr. Kola Mainin, I don't know, I'm probably butchering his name, an organic chemistry professor at the University of, and I won't even try to do this one, Javaliskla or something like that, and Dr. Grahn, G-R-A-H-N, a multi-physicist at an engineering software firm in Comsol. And that was the team on that, and my news articles are dated June 15th.
The one thing I think is missing from their paper is any calculation of the thrusts for the different experiments.
Yeah. But didn't Sawyer himself have some kind of a theory of how it worked when he published it about electromagnetic theory? And I was always kind of wondering if anybody had ever that was more, you know, really expert at the somewhat this electromagnetic theory calculations had ever tried to see if there was any flaw in that or whether it actually made sense mathematically even.
The consensus seems to be that it just can't work like that because the way he's arguing it, he's violating momentum conservation, but he's not bringing any new physics into it.
Right.
And I don't think you can do that. I think if it's going to work, there really has to be some new physics, which is what I'm trying to say.
But given the relativistic relationships between momentum and energy, I guess, wouldn't you be violating energy conservation at the same time?
Yes, you would. That's right. So I'm saying that a new source of energy is coming in from the zero-point field.
Mm-hmm.
Because these horizons, it's a bit like an ocean. If you've got an ocean with lots of waves on it, and you're in a big ship, and you just sit there because the waves hit you from all directions equally. But if suddenly somebody builds a wall to the side of your ship, then no waves will come from that direction, and you'll start moving towards the wall. And if you don't know about the concept of waves, you'll think it's magic. Something's not adding up. But I think something like that is happening here.
So we're getting into stuff kind of like the Casimir effect and that sort of thing, too?
Yes, it's just like the Casimir effect,
which
has been experimentally demonstrated.
Yes. This is very, very, very fascinating stuff.
You're in the wrong career, John. You should have been a laboratory research physicist.
Well, that's one possibility, but that was years ago. Anyway, I do try to keep up with things, and I'm very interested in anything that can lead to advances in space propulsion. You know, I guess because of the fact that if something like this isn't possible, our future in space is, I think, going to be somewhat limited. Not that we can't do a lot of things in the solar system with reaction-based systems, but, you know, there are limitations to that, and
there's a very good NSF forum actually about the M drive. You could go on that and see what people are doing. There are many amateurs and other people building M drives.
Okay. Is your forum, do we have a link to that or something?
If you just Google NASA Spaceflight Forum, and then Advanced Systems M Drive, something like that.
Okay.
There are a lot of very good people on there, and they're building M drives. You have to be very careful doing it, but.
So they're building their own model of an M drive to test and research.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
Is that very difficult to build?
It's not very difficult. No, you just need, the copper cavity, magnetron. It's no more complex than a microwave. You just have to be very careful that you shield yourself from the microwaves that you're producing.
Mm.
Otherwise, you can injure yourself. But
I have an interesting question here. When if you take the amount of energy it takes to run one of these devices, okay, and compare that to the energy if you simply had a thruster which just emitted microwaves and developed a thrust or pressure due to the microwaves. Does this thing consume more energy or less energy than that to produce equivalent thrust? That would be a very interesting question.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know the answer.
Something to think about, huh? It just occurred to me that to make it an effective system practically, it would have to beat just pure radiation pressure, because obviously that can produce a thrust, but a very minute one also with a tremendous energy budget, you know. I mean, you could just take a microwave like a radar, the magnetron, and just shoot them out into space, and that would give you a thrust, but it would take tremendous energy to produce a usable thrust, you know.
Yeah, I have a feeling it's a lot smaller than what they're seeing on the M drive. But I'm not sure. There's a formula, isn't there? It forces power in divided by the speed of light, something like that.
Yeah.
I have an email, John. You might also want to comment on this. This is from Kim, who is in Mexico. Actually, she posted this on the blog. And she said, would the phenomenon relate to Alcubierre's work as well? So that's his work on faster than light travel that Dr. White and others at NASA and Dr. March are also working on. So how are they related, I guess, is the question.
I would think not very. I mean the other is based, like it is definitely based on general relativity and it's based on some really exotic matter creating a rather unique field, right? I mean,
as far as I remember, yeah.
Right, yeah.
And that's designed toward, hypothetically, to build a faster-than-light capability, where this would be more of a, like the Star Trek impulse drive or something.
the interesting thing about that is that in my paper I predicted that the speed of light does change within the cavity, which is also causing a lot of...
Well, they don't like that one either.
No.
I'm sure of that. Yeah, you're all full of, well, of loves and kisses for the mainstream physics community.
Well, the speed of light does vary in different materials, you know, dielectric.
Yes, in a dielectric, yeah.
Yeah, materials anyhow, that's very mainstream. And in fact, you know, they're so-called Cherkinov radiation, where things actually are moving faster than the speed of light in the medium in question, but not the speed of light in vacuum. You know, so that may not be a problem. You have to question whether the fields would make those changes, but it'd be possible, maybe. You're doing a lot of complex analysis to figure all those details out, though. That's the problem. If the mainstream refuses to engage on this, there's a lot of brain power out there that simply refuses to look at it. You know, and if you could get them working on it, who knows what they could come up with rather quickly, but they're, like you said, it's almost, you know, science has a characteristic a little bit like religion and theology, and if you get outside, if you commit heresy, you're kind of in trouble.
Well, there's been a very nice chap here, there in California.
Yeah.
Douglas Singleton. I've been swapping emails with him a little bit. He was concerned that I was assuming that photons have a Vesmas, and in fact I wasn't. It's not the photon rest mass would be a severe problem. But,
yes. It would definitely change the equations a little bit there, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of evidence it doesn't. What?
You have an email question from Carol, who is in Seattle, and Carol says, if this was adopted for interplanetary spaceflight, for example, to Mars, how big would it be, and would solar power be sufficient, or would you need your power source to be nuclear?
Yeah, that sounds a bit practical. I'm not very good at practical questions. Most of the work I do, I sit at my desk and I scribble on pieces of paper.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. I'm not really the person to ask.
Yeah, one thing that kind of relates that too is how, like, I think that David that Josh addressed it too a little bit, is how scalable is this? Would you basically make a bigger one of these things to get more power, or would you make a large bank of these smaller ones? That's another practical question. Is this scalable just to make it bigger, or to get more thrust, or is it more like a whole bunch of little ones?
Well, according to what I've said, it doesn't get bigger. The thrust doesn't get bigger if you make it bigger, but it does if you increase the power input. And also it does if you increase the quality factor of the cavity. So that's the number of times that photons bounce around inside it before dissipating. And also if you could reduce the speed of light within the cavity, that would boost it. So if you put ammonia in, ammonia gas, which is a kind of dielectric, that might enhance it.
Why does ammonia gas reduce the speed of light?
It's a dielectric, so light travels more slowly within it. So the equation I've postulated is roughly F is PQL over C, and C is on the bottom. So if you reduce C, you increase the size of the effect.
Interesting. So it's the actual effective speed of light, not the speed of light in vacuum, that really drives that.
Yes. Well, that's what I'm assuming anyway.
Okay.
John, anything else?
Well, I'll stand down for now and continue to listen and see how this conversation develops, maybe, and let's see if anybody else wants to call in with some questions.
Okay. If it's slow on the phones, feel free to call back if you have more questions, okay?
Yeah, if I see some relevant point to get in.
Thank you.
Nice talking to you.
Okay, thank you.
Nice talking to you.
We are at the midway point, so we're going to pause for our 3-minute break right now. So, listeners, please stay where you are, and we will be back in about 3 minutes with Dr. Mike McCullough. We're talking about M-Drive. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Friday Space Show program. And our guest today from the UK is Dr. Mike McAuliffe. We're talking, for the most part, about M-Drive. We have two sponsors for this segment of the program. So the AIAA is one sponsor for our program. And AIAA is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It is the world's largest aerospace professional society. And they have over 30,000 individual members from 88 countries. And they have 95 corporate members. Everyone is busy shaping the future of aerospace every day, advancing the state of aerospace science and technology, and increasing the knowledge of the universe and bringing the world closer together. Their website is AIAA.org. Check it out. And then also Celestis is our sponsor. And remember, they are the premier space memorial organization or company. And their message for today is called A Shooting Star in Final Tribute. In June 2012, Celestis' latest memorial spaceflight, carrying the ashes of 320 people in Earth orbit, re-entered the Earth's atmosphere, blazing like a shooting star into the final tribute for those on board. The flight began earlier that year with a dramatic nighttime liftoff from the Cape, the launch location of Celestis' next Earth orbiting mission, which is scheduled for liftoff later this year. On board the 2012 flight was Mercury 7 astronaut Gordon Cooper's remains, as well as Star Trek actors James Doolan, or Scotty, plus hundreds of people from various walks of life all around the world. While the 2012 mission orbited a little over a month, Celestis' next Earth orbiting mission is designed to orbit our planet for 5 years, joining two other Celestis spacecraft currently orbiting the Earth. Space on board is limited, so contact Celestis today to get your loved one on a shooting star, celestis.org or celestis.com. Our guest has a couple of things that you would be interested in. So first, he has a blog called Physics from the Edge. And you can Google that term, Physics from the Edge, and you can go to the blog, but I'll put the URL in the archive summary of today's program. He also has written a book, which is available on Amazon, with the same title, Physics on the Edge. And he has a website, which I will also put the URL up for on the website, and you can get to that. I think the URL is a little bit too long to read over the air, but this is his website at Plymouth University. And so I will make sure that link is there as well for you. And his blog has really interesting articles, like the one I'm looking at right now from June 11th of this year, is a smoking gun in every galaxy, and he's talking about his theory about inertia at the end of galaxies. Is that correct, Mike?
Yes, that's right. It's the fact that, I guess people know that galaxies are spinning rather too fast, faster than they should. This was discovered in the 1930s and again in the 1970s. They were looking at galaxies like Andromeda and the Milky Way, and their edge stars are moving far too fast to be held in by the matter we can see in the galaxy itself, the matter that's lit up with stars. So astronomers proposed there was an awful lot of dark matter around the edges of the galaxies to hold them in, to provide extra gravitational pull. What I'm saying is, as I said before, that the edge stars are accelerating so slowly, it's right at the edge in deep space, that their onward waves are so long that they are damped by the Hubble horizon. They're nearly as big as the Hubble horizon. And so the inertial mass decreases and the centrifugal force decreases, so you don't need the extra dark matter to hold the galaxies in.
And this is what's in this first article that I'm looking at on your blog.
That's right.
So, listeners, it looking at the article, I have not read it yet. It does require some basic physics, at least, and probably a good deal of, I wouldn't say really heavy advanced math, but some math. So if you're not used to physics or math, you might be challenged a little bit in understanding what he's talking about. So hopefully those of you that have that background will check out his blog and his book, which again is available on Amazon. And how often do you post articles on Physics from the Edge on your blog? Is that something you do quite currently or quite often?
I try to do it every week.
So okay.
Every week, 10 days, that sort of thing.
Have you published on your blog about M-Drive?
Yes. Yeah, there are about 20 articles on there about M-Drive. Probably more. Every time I do something about it, I put it up.
I'm looking for a search feature on your blog. Is there one?
Oh, probably not. I don't know.
I don't see a search in the upper box. So
if you look at the second article down, that's about M Drive.
Okay, so that's Sunday, May 22nd of this year.
Yeah.
What we learned by doing. Okay. So listeners, check it out. Again, I will put the information on the archive summary, so you'll be able to access all of this information, including his book, which is available on Amazon. What do you think it will take for M-Drive to sort of leave the world of the fringe and get more mainstream with more brain power behind it, as our caller John said a little while ago? What kind of event or what has to happen for it to transition to more mainstream physics research?
Well, as John said, an experiment done in outer space would be a great help, because, as he was saying, there's less that can go wrong in outer space. There's nothing else that can interact with the cavity. So that would be good. I think NASA is very important because they have a lot of respect. And they have a paper coming out. People have been waiting for this paper for quite a long time, but they have a paper coming out about it, about their new results.
Do you have any idea when that paper is supposed to be published?
It's supposed to be imminent.
What does that mean?
Yeah, but it has been imminent for a month or two, so.
So any time now, NASA will have a paper coming out on M-Drive. Is that a fair statement?
That's right. And the rumor mill says that it will have more positive results in it. But, of course, that's only a rumor.
So if it does have more positive results in it, does that transition the research to more mainstream, and is it easier to get more funding for
it? Yes, it would, because this is being done by NASA Eagle Works, which I think is at JPL.
Right.
Other NASA institutes, about four of them, have agreed to test it if they can get the force above about 100 micronewtons. So if they manage to do that, it will suddenly spread to four other NASA institutes, and we will get a lot more data then. So that will be good.
But you think it's the real thing? You don't think this is coming from an artifact or anything like that?
I think it's the real thing, mainly because it agrees with something that I was already working on. It was very satisfying for me, because I was working on astrophysics, on galaxy rotation and cosmic acceleration, and predicting those things. But I wasn't getting much leverage, because those things can also be explained by dark matter, because the theory of dark matter is so flexible. You can put it anywhere you want, and you can make it all fit. So whenever I predicted a galaxy, astronomers would say, yes, but we can do it with dark matter as well. So I started looking for experiments to predict, and I found Podkletnov's famous experiment, which got me into a lot of trouble, but also Martin Tymar's experiment, which is perhaps more mainstream as well. I could predict that. And then I found the M drive, which I could predict very, very easily. It was just a few lines of math.
You have another email question, and listeners, we're happy to take your email. It is drspace@thespaceshow.com. Phone calls are also welcome if you are available to give us a call. And our toll-free number, again, is, for those of you that can access the phone, 1-866-687-7223. And the line is available now if you do want to call. So we want to hear from you. So Andy is in Tucson, Arizona, and Andy says, I'm really curious if you have any of your students doing work related to M-Drive. Do they show an interest in this, or do they stay away from it because it's not mainstream?
Well, that's rather impossible for me at the moment because I'm, for various reasons, I'm in a marine science and engineering department, and I'm also only part-time, so it's not very easy for me to have research students. So I haven't got any.
So your student work is in a totally different area then?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
But I'm hoping in the future to have some. Just not.
Do you think there's an interest in graduate students in doing this kind of work?
Yes, I think there is. I've had quite a few inquiries about it. There were some a couple of students from California who were doing some work with NASA on a cylindrical M drive, which is a very interesting concept.
What is that concept?
What they tried was instead of having a truncated cone with a wide end and a narrow end, they tried having a cylinder with equal ends but with a dielectric in one of its ends. So this is supposed to change the speed of light within the cavity. And they didn't get any, they got ambiguous results, but it was a very interesting concept. And one of those students was inquiring whether I take research students, and it would be great to set up something like that.
But unfortunately, you don't, do you?
No,
not at this time yet.
No.
And that all of that is really interesting. What about are there intern programs at any places that you know of in the UK or elsewhere in America, some other country, where people can actually work on these types of projects? Do you know of programs around the world where students can participate and get involved and do some of their graduate work in these areas?
It would make a very good final year project for physics students, I think. Several academics from around the UK have written to me saying that they might consider doing this as a third or fourth year project. Because it's really very simple to do as long as you're careful.
It would even be better if it was a CubeSat project where they were going to actually launch it and do it as an academic study project.
Yes, it would. And there are two groups. There's a German-Welsh team who are doing that, and one from California as well.
Do you know the timing of that? Is that something that we're going to see happen soon?
The person in California is trying to get funding for it. At the moment, he's got a crowdfunding request out.
Do you know the name of that crowdfunding request?
No, I don't remember his name, I'm afraid.
Okay.
But that's a very interesting...
I doubt he'd get a grant from NASA, given how quiet they are on the project.
No, probably not. But having said that, I don't want to denigrate NASA, because they're doing a great job in looking at this. I think they're doing exactly what they should be in investigating it, because the potential, if it's correct, would be...
They're just keeping too quiet about it for everybody's pleasure. People,
yes.
You know, the problem is people are really excited about it and, yes. and about its potential. And apparently, I'm not a physicist, you can probably tell that by my question, but apparently there is so much interest in it because nothing that has been researched yet kills it. You know, and says that this is not doable, forget it, trash it, move on. So hope is alive out there, and, you know, everyone wants an alternative to chemical rocket propulsion. So it's got a lot of excitement and energy behind it, and, you know, people want to hear about it.
Well, I suspect this year it's going to take off a little bit. NASA will release its paper when they do. And four other institutes will start to look at it. And once that happens, I think a lot of other people will pay attention.
Of course, depending on what the paper says, it could surprise everybody and say it's been a waste of money, I guess.
Yes, it could.
Although that doesn't seem to be that. Jerry is in Boston, Massachusetts, by email. He says, David, I'm at work. He says, Dr. John and you sort of hastily dismissed Kim's question about Alcubierre and faster-than-light travel and similarities. Let me ask you this. Do you believe there is anything possible like the Alcubierre drive for faster-than-light travel, or is that way too far-fetched and probably a waste of time and money?
Well, I can say something about that and probably get myself into a lot of trouble.
Well, take a deep breath and think twice before you want to do it, but we want you to do it.
Well, I've published it already. So.
Oh, okay, so it's already out there.
In 2008, I published a paper, and the theory I've developed predicts there's a minimum acceleration which depends on the size of the Hubble sphere. So the Hubble sphere is very big, 10 to the 26 meters. So the minimum acceleration it predicts for the cosmos is 2c squared over 10 to the 26 meters. So it's a very small acceleration. But that's actually the cosmic acceleration. It's the acceleration that Rees and Perlmutter saw when they looked at supernovae, that the universe is accelerating away. It agrees with that, which is very encouraging. But the thing is, you might be able to produce a bigger acceleration if you could shrink the size of the cosmos. And I published this paper about this. And the way you might be able to do that is by using metamaterials, which are arrays of conducting materials arranged in such a way that they can bend electromagnetic radiation in a much more dramatic way. So what I predicted was, if you had a shell, a metamaterial shell, quite small, you could reduce the cosmos to that shell's size. So instead of having 2c squared over 10 to the 26, you'd have 2c squared, 2 times the speed of light squared, over the size of that shell, which would be a huge acceleration. And I'm also saying that this acceleration is, well, it's relativity proof, in a sense. It doesn't respect the limitation of relativity that you can't go faster than light. So that's what I said in the paper, and it causes all sorts of other problems with causality and deeper questions of physics like that, and that I can't answer yet. But
what is the name of your paper and how can we find it? Is that on your blog?
It was from 2008, published in the Journal of the British Interplanetary Society, and it's titled "Can the Flyby Anomalies Be Explained by Modified Inertia or Modification?"
Can the flyby anomalies, I'm writing this down so I get it correct for the archive, anomalies be explained by what?
By a modification of inertia.
it be explained by modification of inertia. So we can probably pick that up on the web.
That's right. But please ignore the first three quarters of it, because that's been superseded now. I published another paper about the flyby anomalies, which predicts them far better. But it's the last part of it that, where I talk about the metamaterial shell.
Okay. What is the paper that that superseded it?
I published another paper a year later.
2009.
Yes, modeling the flyby anomalies using quantized inertia, I think it's called.
And that's in the Journal of Viz also?
No, that was in MN RAS. So that's Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society.
Monthly Notices, Royal Astronomical Society.
Yeah.
And it's called Modeling Flyby. What was the full name?
Modeling
of?
The Flyby Anomalies.
The Flyby Anomalies. And that's
using.
Okay.
A modification of inertia.
Using modification of inertia. These papers are not up on your website or anything like that, are they?
They are, actually, yes.
Okay.
I put links to the PDFs on my website, so they're all there. The flyby anomalies are another very interesting observation that I can predict quite well.
You have an email from Australia, and he wants my direct line number, so I'm about to give him that, but let me see if I can read his email to you as well. Hang on, Julian, and I'll get you the direct dial number in just a second. Within electronics, there are concepts of the characteristic impedance of free space, a value of approximately 377 ohms, and the maximum power transfer theorem, which states that maximum power is transferred when the source impedance equals the load impedance. Have your calculations dealt with any of these concepts, and would they hold in such a system?
No, I haven't thought about impedance at all. I would expect them to hold. It's not the electronics itself that I'm saying is different. It's an effect of physics beyond that that I'm changing. So things like that would be the same.
Okay. Julian, I'm sending you the direct dial number if you want to give us a call. And because I don't think toll-free works in Australia. But look for your email. It's coming in. It should come there in just a second or two. I have another question from you. Sally is in Chicago. And Sally says, I am a first-year physics undergraduate student. Is there any way you know of where you can study sort of fringe projects like this in mainstream physics programs? The teachers don't seem to be very supportive of it as projects or something that one wants to do. Maybe graduate school is different, but I'm an undergraduate.
Yes, it's. I think it's very difficult. I've had emails from students telling me things like that. But the only thing I can suggest is if you have a chance to do a third-year project, you could suggest something to do with the M-drive. That would be the place to do it. I don't know if it works the same way in America as it does in the UK, where we have a third-year practical project for students.
Well, that or you have some kind of a paper or something that you need to write. So, you know, maybe, but I would think that if NASA does publish this paper you've been talking about, and it is positive for M-drive, that all of this might change.
Yes, I think it would. If they if you got a peer-reviewed publication out, then it would be harder for people to point at it as fringe. It would be probably impossible to classify it as fringe then, which would be good.
This is George, and George is in Los Angeles, California. David, I'm at work, so I'm using email. I know you don't like it, but it is what it is this morning, and here is my question. It's about timelines. So, doctor, if this could be verified as a real effect, and somehow it was able to be commercially used or you put into rocket propulsion, are we looking at something that would change our rocket propulsion for space travel in 10 years or 20 years or 50 years? Do you have any idea how far out development of this would be in order for it to become used in regular space projects?
Well, my... Yeah, that's a very difficult question, because I think there's quite a lot going on behind the scenes that most people are not aware of.
What do you mean by that?
Well, comments by Roger Scheuer, the inventor of the M-Drive, he's claiming that a lot of commercial companies are already working on this, and I don't know how accurate that is, but...
So this could already be underway, is what you're saying.
Yes, but I'm not so sure about it. I'm not sure what he means by they're working on it. Are they studying it or actually starting to make things? My guess would be 10 years, something like that. But it's a very difficult question to answer. Because,
you have another phone call from another listener. Good morning, California time. Listener, where are you, and welcome to the Space Show. What is your name also?
Good morning, David. This is Julian. Julian from Sydney, Australia.
Welcome, mate. How are you?
Good. Kicking. Alive and kicking.
Well, you can't complain then, can you? So let's see. We have the UK on the line, in the United States and Australia, so we've made a nice loop here. So go ahead, Julian. You have the microphone with our guest.
Right. Well, my question was, maybe I should have said electromagnetics rather than electronics, because the characteristic impedance applies more to, I guess, antenna work, or propagation of electromagnetic radiation. And I was thinking that what they mean by free space is essentially vacuum. And I thought that there might be application there.
So... Do you have is this a question for Mike, or a comment or a clarification?
It's more just I guess an exploratory question. I sort of wondering if there's any connection between the two, and also with maximum power theorem. There is a further extension of the maximum power transfer theorem, but it starts to get a bit complicated, and I don't think your listeners want to know about it.
So what's the question? Are you saying that we can change the impedance and improve the performance of the M-drive?
No, I don't. I think the characteristic impedance would be universal. I don't think it's something that you can move. But your thrust is going to be reacting against that characteristic impedance. So I guess I'm thinking of the system as an electrical circuit. but at the same time also having a physical characteristic.
Ah, so you're thinking that the movement of the cavity will start to have knock-on effect.
Yes, that's maybe what I'm thinking about. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's something I've not considered. I should say that that's, well, I'm not sure, but that seems to be a bit of a detail that needs to be looked at a bit later.
Yeah. That's probably.
Yeah.
I guess
so many things.
You'd have to actually build it and prove it in concept.
I've had a very simple model for the actual waves within the M drive. They will resonate within the M drive, and it's a complicated shape. And there's no way I've been able to model that. So the model I've come up with has just assumed that they go from the narrow end to the wide end, and that's it. But in fact, they'll go into all the corners, and they'll bounce around all sorts of different ways, and they'll resonate in different ways as well. And I've been unable to do that. What I'd really need is a cavity. Somebody like yourself who's an expert on cavity electromagnetics, something like that.
Well, I think some of the, especially the work with various multi-physics packages like COMSOL, or I think there's Rhino 3D.
NASA used COMSOL. The paper they sent me used COMSOL.
Yeah, COMSOL. You can measure those parameters.
Mm.
I did glance at the finished paper before the program, but I didn't have time to read and absorb it all. And from what they were illustrating from the pretty color pictures that they provided, that sort of showed me that there was sort of a transition of modes, what they call transverse electric and TE and TM modes within the cavity. But it's sort of starting to get beyond my own knowledge of electromagnetics as well.
Yeah, it can resonate in several ways, and it seems the thrust is different depending on the mode you get. But my theory isn't able to cope with that yet. Maybe I should start using computer models as well, but I don't really trust them.
No, you've got to know what you're modeling, and you've got to work it out on paper first before you stick it in the computer.
Yes, I have a kind of principle that if I can't work something out on one sheet of A4 paper, then it's not worth it, and I don't like the fact that computer models have lots of parameters that are hidden away.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
they can be tuned, you know.
Yep. Okay. Well, thanks very much for dealing with my question.
Thank you very much.
I
wish you all the best. Thank you for your call,
Julian. Bye. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye bye. I hope he wasn't trying to say anything else when I went ahead and disconnected him. If so, I apologize, Julian. We are coming up on the end of our program, and so any closing comments, predictions, takeaway points, pearls of wisdom, something you would like to share or leave with us today?
I just say that I think in some sense that physics has crystallized a little too much around the standard model, and that the best way to do it is to look for anomalies, which is something that I like to do. Of course, when you do that, it's always a bit of a gamble, because it could be an experimental glitch. But I think that's the way to do physics, and I think the M drive is a prime example of that. It's an anomaly, it can't be explained. And I think it's pointing the way to a whole new kind of physics that I've talked about, where that there are horizons, and when you put them in a zero-point field, you can get new kinds of energy out. So anyway, that's my comment. It's good to look at anomalies, and they can teach you things.
Doctor, it's been a pleasure getting to know you and talking to you, and we will start following your blog and your work, and hopefully when we call on you in the future on M-Drive or something else, you'll be able to come back on the show and talk to us and comment and help clarify what we're reading or we're hearing about, because
sure.
I have a feeling this is going to be an exciting topic for a long time to come.
I think so.
And if we need help with the peer-reviewed paper when it comes out, because I don't know that Sunny or others will, maybe they'll be allowed to speak freely at that point. I don't know. But I may call you and say, what does all this mean?
And, sure, I will certainly be reading it very carefully when it comes out.
Well, so will we, but you'll probably understand it, and a lot of us probably will wonder what it all means even after we've read it. So look for our call again at that time, and I'm sure I'll find out about it when it comes out. I'm sure I'll get news alerts and things like that for it. But if you can remember, because you probably are looking in more specific places, if you can let me know that it's out, or if you have it, if you can send a copy or email me the link to it or something, just to make sure that I see it, I would greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, sure, I'll do that.
Okay, and we will get this show archived later on, and I'll send you the links and the locations for where it is. And again, I thank you very much for coming on the show. It's been an honor to get to know you and talk to you, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you again down the road on the Space Show.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Listeners, that's it for today. Now, remember, Sunday is Father's Day over here on this side of the pond. So there is no show on Sunday. We resume Monday, and we have somebody from the Hubble Space Science Program, the telescope, is going to be on. And I met this person in Chicago when I delivered my talk at the University of Chicago Space Fair, or whatever they called that event. And you're in for a real treat, and we look forward to that. And so our next program will be Monday. Again, no show on Sunday. And thanks again, everybody, for participating today with your phone calls and your emails. And thanks again to Professor Mike McAuliffe from Plymouth University in England. And everybody have a great rest of the week and a terrific weekend coming up and an upcoming first day of summer. Thank you all. Goodbye from the Space Show.